From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Offshore oil and gas exploration, could it come to the North Carolina coast? Waters along the eastern seaboard from Virginia to Georgia are included in a draft plan released by the Obama administration at the end of last month. If the area is not at some point excluded from the proposal, lease sales could happen by 2021. Almost as soon as Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell announced the draft plan that will set the boundaries for oil and gas drilling and development until 2022, opponents of drilling and critics of the proposal began lining up. Environmentalists say the risks of seismic testing, drilling, and oil spills pose an unacceptable threat. Advocates for the oil and gas industry complain the proposed map is woefully inadequate, keeping the Pacific, large swaths of Alaskan waters, and the eastern Gulf of Mexico closed to drilling. On today's edition of Coastline, we'll explore the economic case to be made for and against drilling off the coast. We'll also take a look at the environmental concerns. Later in the show, we'll be joined by a conservative economist, an environmental advocate, and a spokesperson from America's Energy Forum. But first, to help us understand the draft plan and how it might unfold, we're joined by Abigail Ross Hopper. She's the director of the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management in Washington, D.C. Director Hopper, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Why did the Mid-Atlantic region emerge as one of the potential areas for offshore oil and gas exploration? And why is the entire Pacific coastline excluded from the proposal? How ultimately were regions included or excluded from the draft plan?
Sure. So the way that we are governed by a statute, and what the statute tells us is that we have to take a careful look at all 26 planning areas all around the United States. So every piece of the outer continental shelf is included in a planning area. So we took a careful look at all the planning areas. We invited comment from the public, from state governments, from tribal governments, from industry, from environmental organizations, anyone that was interested to give us their opinion on what areas they were interested and thought should be developed for oil and gas development and what areas they thought should be excluded from consideration. So we heard from many governors. Ultimately, we heard from over 500,000 people about their opinions, and we took all of that into account. There has been a long history of not drilling. After a period of drilling in the Pacific Ocean, there has been several decades of excluding that area, and the governors of Washington, Oregon, and California were united in their desire not to have any drilling off the coast of the Pacific. So the Pacific is not included in the draft plan.
So, Director Hopper, if all of the 22 coastal states, if governors from those 22 states had indicated strong opposition to oil and gas exploration off their shores, would BOEM have dropped the program?
No, BOEM would not have dropped the program. Governor's input is one aspect that we look at. Mm-hmm. Many other aspects that we look at include the potential for the resource there, sort of understanding how much oil and gas we think lies in that area. We look at sort of the energy security of our nation. That is part of our statutory obligation. We look at the environmental impact. We look at the other uses of the ocean. The other users of the ocean and how these things can coexist. And so as we looked at the Mid-Atlantic and the South Atlantic, there certainly was governor interest, state government interest in many of those states, which was important, but there is also an interest in understanding the resource there and taking a careful look at how we can balance some of those environmental concerns as well as some of industry's interest in exploring that area off the Mid and South Atlantic. And that's why it's included in this draft plan.
Abigail Ross Hopper with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, can you take us through a sketch of a timeline? We start first with seismic testing, is that right, to quantify the oil and gas reserve that might exist off the coast?
Mm-hmm. So there's sort of two. There's a timeline for getting to the final plan, which will set the areas that are able to be leased from 2017 to 2022. And I can walk you through that timeline. But functionally, sort of how will oil and gas actually be produced, you're exactly right. First, we need to understand the resources that are out there. The data that we have is over 30 years old. And so, obviously, technology has improved dramatically in that time period. And so last summer, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management issued a programmatic environmental impact statement to allow for the permitting of that geological and geophysical testing, so to really understand what those resources are. And we have permits pending that have been filed and are pending at our bureau that we're taking a look at. So that's the first step. Once companies understand what the resource is, and if and when we have the Mid and South Atlantic in the final proposed plan, the final program, excuse me, then they would move forward on exploring those areas.
How long might the testing phase be, and how soon could it start in the Mid-Atlantic region?
Well, the testing phase, we have permits pending currently, and once those permits are issued, they are good for 1 year, so that the companies will be out in the ocean surveying for up to a year.
And how soon could that start?
That could start as soon as we issue the permits. As I said, the permits have been filed, and once they are issued, the surveying can take place.
Can you give us a ballpark in terms of time frame on that? I mean, I understand the permits are pending, but...
Right. No, I appreciate that. We're not the only entity that's involved in the permitting process.
Mm-hmm.
NOAA, the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, has a part to play. And so that's why I'm having a hard time giving you an exact time frame, because it's not totally within our control. But we think it'll be a period of months.
Months, okay. And who makes the ultimate determination? Would it be the oil and gas producer about whether testing is successful and the reserves actually warrant drilling?
So the companies will, the industry will do that testing. They do share some of their information with us as a bureau, but they are the ones that do that testing.
And what would exclude an area from this plan? We understand that areas, as this process goes along, can be removed from the draft plan. Nothing can be added. But what might take an area out of this draft proposal?
Sure. I'm glad you asked that question. So the process we have just embarked upon is scoping for the draft environmental impact statement. And that is where we take a very careful look at the environmental impact of oil and gas development in this area. We have invited the public to comment. We're holding a scoping meeting in Wilmington soon, and we asked the public to help us understand what areas of sensitivity they think we need to take a more careful look at. So we will do that. If after those environmental assessments, the Secretary decides that an area needs to be excluded, then she will make that decision.
By opening up areas for oil and gas exploration and definitively closing some of these environmentally sensitive areas, the entire Pacific, parts of the Alaskan Seas to drilling, is that making the Mid-Atlantic something of a sacrificial lamb environmentally? How did this get decided from an environmental perspective? Are the environmental aspects of, say, these Alaskan areas that are closed to exploration more biodiverse than, say, the Mid-Atlantic? Or what's the criteria?
No, I don't think it would be a fair characterization to say there's been some sort of hierarchy in treating of geographic areas. The areas in Alaska that the president withdrew last month are areas in which we had a lot of science and a lot of understanding about what the impacts and the resources were. And that is one of the things that we are still evaluating here in the Mid-Atlantic. I think we are at the exact right point to be asking these questions. Where are the incredibly diverse and valuable areas off of the Mid and South Atlantic that we should be taking a careful look at? And that's why the stakeholder engagement and stakeholder feedback is so important to us. But ultimately, I just want to say these are decisions that are based on science, on really understanding what the environmental impact of potential development is on these areas.
Many people have heard that this area is also a favorite spot for offshore wind. In fact, there's a public meeting tonight that your department, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, is holding, I believe, here in Wilmington to talk about mm-hmm. offshore wind. Can offshore wind and offshore drilling coexist in this area?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We think that the two forms of energy can absolutely coexist in that area.
How does that work? Is it because of this 50-mile buffer zone, or how, just from a logistical standpoint?
I think from a logistical standpoint, the wind resource is best closest to the shore, of North Carolina. And the offshore, as you have identified, there's a 50-mile buffer in which offshore oil and gas could not be developed. And so those two can happen simultaneously.
Abigail Ross Hopper, Director of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Coming up after the break, we'll take a closer look at what oil and gas exploration off the coast of North Carolina could mean economically and environmentally. If you'd like to ask a question, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You're listening to Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking about the potential for offshore drilling near North Carolina. And with me in the studio now is Algernon Cash, National Director of Minority Engagement for America's Energy Forum, which self-identifies as a nonpartisan community of concerned citizens and partners, including the American Petroleum Institute, committed to achieving energy security for the U.S. and holding elected officials accountable for shaping energy policy. Algernon Cash, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
Joining us also to help parse the potential economic implications locally is UNCW Cameron School of Business Professor Craig Galbraith. Dr. Galbraith, welcome.
Good afternoon.
And from the North Carolina Coastal Federation, we're joined by Mike Giles, an environmental advocate with a coastal focus based in Wilmington. Mike Giles, welcome to the program.
Rachel, happy to be here.
You're invited to join the discussion. If you have a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. Craig Galbraith, would oil and gas development offshore be a boon for the state of North Carolina economically?
I think you have to look at it a couple ways. Certainly, it may generate some revenues, although there are concerns about what sort of revenues might actually flow to the state of North Carolina. I don't believe there'd be a lot of job increases here. The thing that we have to look out for, I think, is that we already have very, very rapid development of oil and natural gas resources within the United States. We've grown about 15% per year now for several years. And there's a danger of growing too rapidly in what are called extractive industries. So we need to be careful about going too fast in some of these issues. And that's a different issue than simply the environmental issue.
And what do you mean by a danger of growing too rapidly? What's the danger other than, you know, we'll talk about the environmental risks in a moment. But
well, in economics, this is actually what's called the Dutch disease. I'm not sure why it's called the Dutch disease, but this is where you have an extractive industry that grows very, very quickly. And what they find is that the resources and employment are taken away from the more productive areas within an economy, such as manufacturing. You can see this in Canada. It's happened many, many times. There's nothing wrong with extractive industries. We just have to be very careful about the speed by which we go. So as you develop these things, and we can see it in North Dakota and South Dakota right now, there are a lot of people moving there because there is so much going on. And with the drop in oil prices, now we're starting to see a lot of people struggling in these particular areas. So we just need to go slow.
So you're saying Dutch disease means that the current resources available, human resources, would be drained off of a current industry and plugged into this new sort of
right.
Golden
child. It's one of the phenomena of this sort of thing is where you have the productive manufacturing sectors actually getting hurt if you go too quickly within extractive sort of things. And obviously the major extractive industry here that we're talking about is the oil and gas industry.
Algernon Cash, the American Petroleum Institute has been very critical of this draft plan and said that it's keeping 80% of the potential resource closed to exploration. Of course, Secretary Jewell of the Department of the Interior says it's a balanced proposal that would make available nearly 80% of the undiscovered technically recoverable resources. How do you account for that difference in the way we're looking at what's being made available here to the industry?
Yeah, I think it'd be tough to say that we feel like we're not being critical of BOEM's draft plan. And in fact, we're very thankful that BOEM has finally realized something that we realized many, many years ago, that the Mid-Atlantic should be open to offshore energy exploration, not only oil and gas, but wind production as well. So we're thankful to BOEM for finally realizing something that we've known for a very long time. What we ask, though, is that BOEM really gives serious consideration to advancing the one lease area sale that they've already identified. You know, they've identified that they're going to make that sale in 2021. We believe that sale should occur much earlier in the process.
And you're talking about the Mid-Atlantic lease.
Correct. That's right. That's right. So the only critical nature that we have of the draft plan is that we just believe the sale should be accelerated.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the potential for oil and gas exploration off the coast of North Carolina. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 to ask a question of any of our guests, or you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Ittorio, am I pronouncing your name correctly? Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. It's actually Victorio.
Victorio. That's a V.
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much. To your guest, my question is thus, would it not be sacrificing the fishing industry to bring in oil off the coast of North Carolina? I don't think that, to me, that's not very wise, my humble opinion.
It's the commercial fishing industry here is an important part of the state's economy, the local economy. Algernon Cash.
Yeah, not only is it very important to our economy here in North Carolina, it's very important to our Gulf states as well. And, you know, I would tell Victorio that, you know, we've been exploring for oil and gas in the Gulf Coast for many, many years. There's actually been hundreds of thousands of wells done all around the world when you look at offshore production, and we've been able to do it safely and responsibly. So, you know, Victorio, my message to you would be, to think that you have to make a choice between abundant and affordable energy and then a safe environment, that's a false choice. I believe that we can have a vibrant commercial fishing industry. I believe that our tourism will remain vibrant, but yet we can still find a way to do exploration and production safely and responsibly.
Victorio, thanks so much for your call. Algernon Cash, Mike Giles with the North Carolina Coastal Federation. When we start to raise these questions about how other industries like the commercial fishing industry might be affected, it also calls to mind some of the environmental disasters that we've had in recent history, the 2010 BP Deepwater Horizon accident, the biggest accident in history. How do you... It sort of strains credulity. BP was found grossly negligent in that case. So what do you say to people who are concerned about that? That doesn't sound like a great record.
Yeah, well, we certainly need to be very concerned about the BP oil spill. I think that your listeners and others who are concerned about the issue, I think the real focus needs to be put on what have we done since the spill occurred. So what have we done to make sure it's prevented? And if another spill was to happen, what have we done to make sure that we can intervene properly and that we have the right type of technology and equipment on hand to make sure that we can mitigate any damage to the environment? And I would argue that since that spill occurred in 2010, the industry and government has come together very successfully to craft new policies, new regulations, new processes and procedures to try to make sure that we have the right measures in place to prevent, intercede properly, and respond capably to another spill if it was to occur. And then I would also add that, you know, it was a great disaster, and we do need to be very sensitive to that. However, if you were to ask your listeners to point to another oil disaster prior to that, they would probably bring up the Exxon Valdez from the early 90s. My point in saying that is we actually have we've actually lost more people from disappearing airplanes than we have from these disasters. So the bottom line is we're not here today having a debate whether or not we should shut down the flight industry or we shouldn't fly airplanes any longer. No, these disasters occur. We learn from them and we figure out how to do it better, more safely and more responsibly. And I think that same protocol should apply to the oil and gas industry.
And there was a national commission that was formed after the BP accident. One of the scientists from that commission says we should also require full environmental impact statements for lease sales and for sites with complex geology or ultra-deepwater frontier areas. And the scientist says all offshore drilling assessments must be shaped by the best science, and we can elevate the role of scientific research by creating a distinct science division within the federal oversight structure. In other words, this person is saying this is one of the big missing pieces, because right now there's a great reliance on the industry for data and for self-policing.
Well, that's true. And that same commission, I would also add, said that offshore energy production is now safer today than it has ever been because of the response to the oil spill in 2010. So I agree. And one of the things that was created after that spill, and it was created by the industry, was the Center for Offshore Safety. However, the Center for Offshore Safety has been working very closely with the Bureau for Safety and Environmental Enforcement to make certain that the industry is policed the proper way. So what you just highlighted is actually occurring right now through a collaboration between the industry and government.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the potential for offshore drilling in North Carolina. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138. We have an email from Anonymous who has a few questions here. The first one, how much gas or oil would have to be found to make it economically feasible for the industry to use our coast for their economic benefit?
Well, I can possibly answer
Craig
that
Galbraith.
It's not so much the amount, but the price that is being pulled out. Again, there's always a break-even cost for any economic sort of thing. When you look at the cost per barrel and how it's gyrated between $40 is up to about $50 per barrel, now up to over $100, we don't really know the cost of what it's going to take per barrel to pull that out. In Texas, the break-even point is about $40 to maybe $70, and Alaska, it's under $40, North Dakota up to $80. If we find that it's going to cost $30 to pull it out, they're going to pull out a lot. If it's $100, no one's going to drill for it.
How would they get the raw product from the ocean to the port? This is a logistical question. And then where would it go for refinement and processing? Or are they planning on building an oil refinery here because it would be more efficient?
There's no current plans at all whatsoever, any discussion at all whatsoever, to have a refinery built off the coast of North Carolina. So most of the refining industry is based down in the Gulf. So I think you'll continue to see the industry transport the resource there for refinement. But you just brought up a great point. You asked the question, how do they get the resource back from the offshore rig back on the coast? Well, they're going to have different types of companies providing that transport. And that's where this big, huge indirect jobs opportunity comes from. You know, I've got great friends. I'm great friends with the mayor of Kinston, B.J. Murphy, and I've went down and visited Greenville, and I've been up to Rocky Mount, and I've spent a lot of time in eastern North Carolina. These people are desperately in need of jobs. And if we're able to move forward with offshore production, the types of indirect jobs that we could create around what you just identified, that puts these people in eastern North Carolina back to work. And that's why we're so passionately trying to promote this concept.
Now, that's an interesting point, Algernon Cash, with America's Energy Forum, because Craig Galbraith, when you were taking a look at offshore wind a year or so ago, one of your criticisms of this as an economic boon for the state was that much of the manufacturing of the parts for the turbines would be done in China and it would be shipped here. Many of the jobs that would be created here would be temporary construction jobs. Are the jobs that Algernon is talking about, those indirectly related jobs, are those temporary, or is this something that would have to be ongoing?
Well, certainly when you look at the economics, there's several components. There's the construction process. There are the parts and the components that will go into it. We don't exactly know. Certainly one of the complaints I have had when we talk about any sort of federal lands being allocated for any sort of economic activity, whether it's on land or offshore, is that we should make sure that those components and that construction process is being given to Americans. And I think that's very, very important. We don't really know exactly what the indirect employment is going to be because we don't have the facilities yet. We don't know how it's going to take place. They may load it up on ships there and take it down to the Gulf Coast. We really don't know the situation. It's very difficult to determine what the economic impact is.
And we have another caller, Susie from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, Ralph.
Oh, hi, Ralph. Okay.
How are you?
Welcome.
Thank you. One of your men made the analogy between the deaths from the Gulf oil spill and airplane flight deaths, which I thought was really strange. And as bad as the deaths were, it was the environmental catastrophe that was that the impact of that was the true disaster of that. And I know you talk about all these new things, the improvements. Have them guarantee us that anything like that damn thing that happened down there ain't going to happen here.
There's some real concern there, Algernon Cash.
No, that's real. That is real concern. And Ralph, I appreciate you calling. I appreciate you listening today because obviously you care a lot about the issue. You know, I would just say no one can ever offer you a guarantee. You go ask American Airlines to offer you a guarantee that they won't have a plane crash. Go ask GM to offer you a guarantee that no car is ever going to crash. There's no industry, there's no company that will ever provide you a guarantee. The bottom line is, the point that I was trying to make in my analogy is that we have a lot of other risk and a lot of other things happen with a lot of other industries. Right now in our country, you have more people dying from car crashes every year than you have from any other source out there. But again, we're not here on the show today talking about stopping people or banning people from driving. No, what we do is we use police and we use rules and we stop lights and we try to do it safely and responsibly. It doesn't quite prevent every risk. It doesn't get rid of every accident, but we do it safely and responsibly. And my only argument is that we can also do the same thing with the oil and gas industry. We live in the greatest country in the world with some of the smartest people, some of the most innovative, and some of the most creative people right here in America. And I'm not convinced that we can't find a way to do this safely and responsibly.
Ralph, thanks so much for your call. Holly, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I am new to Wilmington, but I studied environmental sustainability at Meredith, and I appreciate Ralph's comment because that was what I was really curious about as well. Is there are certainly no guarantees with any industry that accidents aren't going to happen, but that is where regulation really comes into play. And I agree with Mr. Cash that there is this misconception that a safe environment and a flourishing economy can't coincide, but that does require acceptance and a willingness to have conversations about really strict local and state regulations, and that cuts into profits. And so if we're talking about doing this off of the coast of North Carolina, the only guarantee that this isn't going to happen on an industry level is to not do it. So if there aren't any guarantees, how open are you as a member of this industry to really strict regulations, even if it cuts into the bottom line?
So, Holly, you're almost addressing the not in my backyard argument. We've heard people say it'll be interesting for some of the governors of these states that have said we're very much in support of seeing this kind of oil and gas development off the coast. What will happen when they start to see some of the first environmental impacts?
Yeah, just to respond to Holly, I mean, I think she was asking me how in favor am I of strict regulation. I'm very in favor of it. Holly, let me tell you, I've got an 11-year-old little girl. I love her to death. I don't want her breathing dirty air or drinking dirty water any more than anybody else in this state. My daughter loves to go to the beach. She loves to curl her toes in the sand, and I want to continue to take her there and enjoy it with her. So I do believe that we need to have strict regulations and make sure we have the right rules and the right standards and best practices in place so that we can do this safely and responsibly. And I think my friends in the environmental community, where they can use their energy best, and no pun intended, is to help us craft the right regulations. Instead of trying to be an obstacle and instead of trying to say no all the time, work with us in collaboration to make sure we have the right rules in place so we can prevent the kind of issues that happen down at the Gulf Coast.
Holly, thanks so much for your call. And Mike Giles with the North Carolina Coastal Federation. The Coastal Federation, as soon as this draft proposal was announced, had some pretty serious criticism of the proposal and raised some questions. What are some of those questions that the Federation's concerned about?
There's been some good discussions and good calls. You know, this is all about what does North Carolina want to be for our future generations? We have one of the most a national treasure of our coast. We're located on the Graveyard Atlantic. We have the most unique coastal ecosystem in North America. Is the risk worth the rewards? We don't believe so. We need to think beyond the box. Algernon talks about strict regulations, but the federal government is hammered by industry continually to weaken, to not have strict regulations on a lot of issues that concern the environment, the economy, and our human health. What we need to do is thinking about putting our homegrown energy into and our human experience and human abilities into thinking beyond this transient industry. It will only be on our coast if it ever is permitted to be here for a short period of time. There's just a drop of oil and natural gas located off of our on our continental shelf.
You're saying there's just a drop of oil and natural
compared
gas?
Compared to our U.S. demand daily, it's just an infinite amount. Is the risk worth the reward? We don't think so. We think this five-year plan should include a comprehensive energy strategy, just not oil and gas, but a comprehensive energy strategy that takes into account what happened to the word of conserve. We no longer have conservation efforts in the United States on how much electricity we use, how many miles per gallon our cars can get. If they increase the miles per gallon requirement of our cars to 35 miles per gallon, we would save 1.1 million gallons of oil per day. We are located in the Graveyard of the Atlantic, the most volatile, the most dynamic coastal ecosystem there is. Is this risk worth the reward? We don't think so.
And we'll talk more about that when we come back. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. If you have a question for our guests, give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. With me in the studio once again from America's Energy Forum, Algernon Cash, UNCW's Cameron School of Business, Dr. Craig Galbraith, and the North Carolina Coastal Federation's Mike Giles. If you have a question or a comment for any of our guests, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us at CoastlineHQR. And we did have a caller on the line who was, we've got a few calls on the line now, but he's since gone. However, he raised the issue of fishing industry being benefited by oil rigs. Is that a thing? Is that a real thing, Algernon Cash?
Well, I'm sure my friends in the environmental community will disagree with me, but yes, we do think that is very real. I had the opportunity back in 2013 to host or was a part of the host team for the South Carolina Coastal Energy Summit. And we had people up from the Gulf Coast, including owners of fishing companies, commercial fishing companies in the Gulf. And we had this dialogue. And I actually heard it firsthand from them that they really like pulling up to the rigs, dropping their nets, because quite frankly, they pick up a lot of fish. So I think your caller is accurate. If you go down there and had a conversation in the Gulf, you'd find that the fishing industry is very responsive to the idea of rigs being out in the Gulf.
Mike Giles, what's the Coastal Federation's take on that point?
Well, we're talking about oil rigs. We're talking about structures. And the fishing industry can be benefited from structures in the ocean waters, of course. Does it have to be an oil rig and the hazards that oil rig brings? In the Gulf Coast, you're no longer allowed to eat a speckled trout in Galveston Bay because the PCBs and toxins that are in those fish. Women and children are warned not to eat fish from the Galveston Bay. The petrochemical industry is responsible for the dead zone in the Gulf Coast. But let's talk about North Carolina. Our coast generates over 51,000 jobs. Our coastal economy generates over 51,000 jobs and generates nearly $2.2 billion in our gross national product. This is something, ask the fishermen that could not catch shrimp and oysters and shellfish and crabs in the Gulf Coast if oil rigs benefit commercial and recreational fishing. It can, but it doesn't have to be an oil rig. It could be an offshore structure that our state puts out into the waters to attract fish, not to produce oil. The National Academy of Science estimates that a single well produces between 1,500 and 2,000 tons of waste material that is leaked and deposited on the seafloor. It includes lead, cadmium, mercury, benzene, arsenic. And this isn't regulated. It's just dumped on the floor from the drilling operation. So, again, and what I heard Secretary Hopper say, that the governors have decided that they want this off our coast. The governor has decided. I think it's up to the people to decide whether they want this heavy, hazardous industry on our critical coastal waters.
And speaking of the people, let's take a call. Albert from Raleigh, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
I just have a question for Mr. Giles.
Mike Giles,
regarding,
yes.
Seismic testing for wind. I've noticed that you do support wind energy.
The Coastal Federation, you're saying, supports offshore wind.
That's correct.
Yes.
I've also noticed that you've been warning people about the impact that seismic testing has for oil and gas. So what's your position on seismic testing for wind? Because you do have to shoot seismic to place a wind turbine in the water.
Mike Giles.
Our position on wind energy, our position on energy is we need to develop a multifaceted, comprehensive energy policy. And that's what I think this effort to have this five-year lease plan for our outer continental shelf is premature. Our government, our elected leaders need to look comprehensively and holistically and develop a energy policy. As far as the seismic testing for wind platforms, I believe it's different than for deep oil research.
It's not the same kind of seismic
Correct.
Testing. There, Algernon Cash, maybe you could speak to this. There are a couple of different kinds.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think your caller is correct. I mean, the bottom line is in order to, for us to have offshore wind production, we're going to have to do seismic testing either way you look at it. And I want to be clear here because I didn't state this earlier, but the America's Energy Forum, we support and all of the above energy policy. We want wind, we want solar, we want geothermal, we want biomass. But the reality is, and my friends in the environmental community, they need to understand this, based on the way demand is growing for energy in our world, in decades to come, oil and gas will still be meeting around 80% of our baseload energy demand. Wind, solar, and other alternative sources will only be meeting 12%. And that's just real science and real facts. So we do have to have an all-of-the-above strategy and approach, but we don't need to forget that, quite frankly, a lot of consumers and a lot of companies are very reliant on oil and gas. And I want to go back and address something that Mr. Giles said a moment ago. He said that there was only a drop of oil or something along those lines in the Atlantic, and that's so far from the truth. Based on 30-year-old data, we believe that you can generate 1.3 million barrels a day out of the Atlantic. And right now, we're producing around 9 to 9.5 million barrels a day in the entire country. So that represents just under 20% of our actual domestic production on a daily basis. I think that's a little bit more of a drop, and we just need to be very honest with the American people. And we also need to be honest in this regard. It wasn't Governor McCrory who decided that he wanted this arbitrarily. 86% of the people support more oil and gas production, and they support it offshore. So we need to get away from this idea that it's some political figure that's making a decision. No, the American people want this, and it's the America's energy, and the American people should be able to have that choice.
Albert, thanks so much for your call. Susie from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me. I have a question about the seismic testing for the effects on marine life. Because out in California, it's been proven that whales and dolphins, for instance, they lose their hearing, and it's actually quite cruel, and sometimes it actually kills them. So how do you answer that when someone says...
That's a good question, Susie. What do we know right now about the effects of seismic testing on marine life?
Essentially, when I was looking at the issue of seismic testing, what I found is that there's really not a lot of scientific evidence one way or the other. Most of what you hear is mostly anecdotal, and people talking about it. Now, again, I think it's very important that we disentangle or detach the idea of seismic testing, which is essentially to get an idea about what is out there. You know, as a conservative economist, I am a big fan of getting information. Having good information is absolutely critical. So I would probably support seismic testing with some very, very careful regulations to make sure that it doesn't affect the marine animal life. But I think we need to disentangle that from the idea of actually drilling offshores. Getting information is a different issue.
Well, before you go on, Dr. Craig Galbraith, the National Geographic published a report that says, and this is talking about the EIS, the Environmental Impact Statement, produced by BOEM, regarding this, regarding seismic testing, said there would be minor to negligible impact to most wildlife, with the exception of marine mammals and turtles, for which impact could be moderate. And the review estimates that about 138,000 marine animals could be injured in some way, and perhaps 13.6 million could have their migration, feeding, or other behavioral patterns disrupted by the seismic surveys. So how are we weighing that? I mean, there would be some kind of impact, and it's just a question of what's acceptable to us.
Yeah, certainly whenever you do something out there in the environment, it's going to have an impact. And again, in the issue of seismic testing, again, most of the evidence is anecdotal. So when they came to that conclusion, that's based upon testimony and these sort of things. But there really aren't a lot of research studies out there that have actually been able to show one way or the other what the situation is. There are a few kind of casual studies, but there's not a lot of really good science one way or the other on seismic testing.
Okay,
and
Mike
that just
Giles.
Goes to show you there needs to be more science.
Yes.
There needs to be more research for before this seismic testing exploratory effort begins or is approved.
And we actually had another listener email and say the wind turbines also attract fish. They bury them in the ocean floor, and then they build up a support system around the base that also attracts fish. No gas drilling necessary or wanted wind. Let's take another call. Richard from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're not on the air. All right, that is a dial tone.
And if I may comment real quickly on the noise issue, I do want to get this across, too, that, you know, when you go to construct these wind turbines, and BOEM has released this in their own statement, when you go to construct these wind turbines, there's a tremendous amount of noise that comes from the construction. So again, I mean, I think we got to have an honest conversation about whether it's wind or whether it's oil and gas. You are going to have some kind of an impact from it. There is going to be some kind of risk from it. We just need to have an honest dialogue about how to mitigate those effects to the environment. But there is no one perfect solution, and we need to make sure the listeners understand that.
And speaking of mitigation and safety measures and regulations, you were saying, Algernon Cash from America's Energy Forum, that you support strict regulations on this kind of industry. Can you cite specific safety measures that you would support or mitigation measures?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have specific measures I would go into on the air right now, but I would say to your point, again, yes, I do support good, strong regulations on the oil and gas industry. I support strong regulations on any industry that obviously can be considered a risky industry. And I think also, Rachel, your listeners need to understand the 9.8 million people who work in the oil and gas industry. They all live here on this planet with us. They breathe the same air as you do. They drink the same water that you do. They go to the same parks that you go to. The other 9.8 million people who work in the oil and gas industry also supports strong regulations so that we protect and preserve our environment.
Richard from Wilmington, I understand you got disconnected, but welcome back to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. If that's a question about from a risk standpoint, trying to compare the location of these proposed wells in relation to, we're going to make a comparison to the Gulf of Mexico or Prince William Sound, it just reasons the risk factor would be far less as far as an environmental disaster with the Gulf Stream and the proximity of the open ocean breaking down any potential spill. Would in fact the risk be far less?
Okay, Richard, you're very difficult to hear, so I'm going to repeat your question. It sounds like you're asking, compared to the BP spill in the Gulf, that the risk, if a spill happened here in the mid-Atlantic because of the Gulf Stream, would the risk be less than it would be in a different area? Is that your question?
Yeah, and the proximity of the open ocean as opposed to the Gulf.
And because we're in the open ocean. Thanks so much for your call, Richard. Mike Giles.
The Gulf Stream is a unique geological feature, oceanic feature in the Atlantic, and it has effects worldwide. The risk, I believe, we believe, would be greater because of the currents, because of the fisheries that are associated with the Gulf Stream and the Labrador currents that occur off New England. We feel like that a oil spill in off our coast would be harder to control, harder to contain, harder to clean up because of the physiological effects of the Gulf Stream.
You're listening to Coastline. We have just a few minutes left in the show. We're talking about the potential for oil and gas exploration off the coast of North Carolina. We have Algernon Cash of America's Energy Forum with us, Dr. Craig Galbraith, professor at UNCW's Cameron School of Business, and Mike Giles of the North Carolina Coastal Federation. The phone number is 910-343-1138. And we have an email from Zachary Keith of the Sierra Club, and he's asking, what has happened since BP regarding safety? And Algernon Cash, we were talking about this a little earlier, but specifically.
Yeah, I think, again, the statement that Mr. Giles just made was more of an opinion, not scientific fact as it relates to the Gulf Stream, and I think that needs to be made clear. I think if you really want to look at the facts around how do we prevent the same thing that happened in the Gulf Coast from happening here off the North Carolina coast, I think you have to look at what industry and the government has done since then. One of the reasons that that happened in the Gulf Coast is that that well was improperly constructed. And then when the spill happened, the right type of equipment and technology wasn't available to contain the well. And that's why it continued to spew out hydrocarbons.
However, was it not available because we didn't have the technology
We had the technology, but the equipment was not located to be able to get there rapidly enough. So what the industry has done since then is they have went back and looked at measures on how to properly construct these wells, number one, so that we can prevent spills. They've also looked at how to make sure we have the right kind of well containment technology so that if a spill does occur, we can get the right equipment and the right technology on site very rapidly. There's now protocols in place to make sure that we have more of these pieces of equipment available around these different types of rigs. And then the biggest thing that they did is they created the Center for Offshore Safety to really start to study how to prevent this from happening again and how to really look hard at response capability.
When
and
you say they, who created the Center
the industry,
for Offshore?
The industry created the Center for Offshore Energy. But then what the government did through the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, they've actually adopted guidelines now from the Center for Offshore Safety and implemented those guidelines in terms of improving the operations and process and so forth. So there's been a lot done, and I'll reiterate this one more time. Our current president, his own oil spill commission, they said unequivocally, offshore energy production is safer today than it has ever been in history.
You're listening to Coastline. We have an email from Christine. She says, I walk on the beach every morning and have the dolphins and sea turtles. They're amazing sights to see. Nothing that would endanger that in any possible way is worth the risk. As far as economic impact, the tourist dollars would surely be impacted if any harm were to occur. And we have just a couple minutes left in the show. Dr. Craig Galbraith, final thoughts.
You know, speaking of economic impacts, everything we're talking about is a cost-benefit analysis. The benefit when we talk about offshore drilling is energy independence, energy security. We're already at that particular point. We're producing right now about 80% of our U.S. needs for energy domestically. Certainly, I think, as Mike mentioned, that we could cut back in terms of our demand for some of these issues. I'm not worried about energy security in the sense of creating more oil. The key thing is energy flexibility, you know, having a portfolio of different type of activities as well as decentralized decision making.
Mike Giles, quickly, final thought.
You know, again, like I said at the beginning, is the risk worth the reward? We feel like it's not. We don't think the reserves, the economics match up. It's not the time to do exploratory drilling off our coast because it's the thing to do now.
Algernon Cash.
Just final thoughts. I would encourage everybody to go to americasenergyforum.com. If you want reliable facts, not just opinions, not platitudes, but if you want expert reliable facts, go to our website and we can get you some great information. And you can always email me directly, acash@americasenergyforum.com.
That's this edition of Coastline. Thanks so much to our guests. Thanks to you, our listeners, those of you who called and emailed. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, here on HQR News 91.3 FM. This is Coastline.
Good afternoon. It's a minute before 1 o'clock. Stay tuned for Here and Now next on HQR News at 91.3 FM.
Support for WHQR comes from our members and Wilmington's own Queensboro.com, celebrating 34 years of providing custom embroidery, T-shirts, and promotional products for small and large organizations across the country. More at Queensboro.com. And from River Road Animal Hospital in Southport, striving to provide progressive health care to dogs, cats, and exotic animals in a pet-friendly atmosphere. 910-454-8910 or on Facebook.
This is WHQR Wilmington 91.3 FM, serving Myrtle Beach at 98.9 on translator W255BZ and Lumberton at 94.1 on translator W231AB. It's 1 o'clock.